This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
I'm Jo Bark. I'm one of the curators that worked on the Homefront exhibition. This is John O'Lanine, who assisted me ably in development of said exhibition. And we're going to chat to you today about the exhibition and how it came to be. Exhibitions have quite a long gestation period. The ideas surface at various points, prompted by a variety of things. And the idea for this exhibition was obviously the looming centenary of the First World War and the centenary of the landing at Gallipoli. So the idea, I think, first started circulating probably in 2011, 2012. Neither Jono nor I were working on the project at that time. And so it's interesting that, you know, quite often because of the length of time it takes for an exhibition to get from idea to opening, there will be a change of personnel on the project. But I think Jono and I both came onto the project when the fun started, so which we'll talk about as we get through. So, you know, the project starts with research, with thinking about what the National Museum has to offer. And with this project, we were always very mindful that what we had to offer necessarily had to be very different from what the war memorial would offer, because they would be the venue that everyone would go to for all their information about the First World War conflict and the fighting specifically. So the National Museum decided that we would focus on the home front and taking a biographical approach to personalise the experiences of Australians during the First World War. So I'm going to hand over to Jono now, who's going to have a chat to you about how we got to the point of having our 23 people featured in the exhibition.
Yeah, so story selection. I think the first thing to keep in mind in relation to that is that we are the National Museum of Australia. So we have to look at the big themes, the national themes. You know, we're not Museum Victoria. If you were to see their World War One show right now, of course, it deals only with Victorians. We're not the Migration Museum or the Jewish Museum or the Maritime Museum. We're the National Museum. So we got to look at the big picture. And the research showed us that there were particular times during that 4 to 5 year period that really resonate with people. One would be that imperial energy at the start of the war, the focus on nationalism and British Empire imperialism. Then the time, you know, when casualties started to come back from the Middle East and Europe, and, you know, slow changes in people's buoyant energy. The conscription referendum in 1916 and 1917 were key moments in Australian history, as was labor unrest, which increased during the First World War. The Catholic-Protestant divide is a key area. Male-female roles, what were they during the war? And, of course, politics, because that four-year period was a particularly tumultuous time in Australian politics. So these are areas that we have to cover through these biographical sketches that we're trying to dig up. And then through the research, we got around 70 stories that dealt with those topics. Now, those stories, the events, they're kind of the typical dots along the timeline of Australian history for that period of time. But, you know, what we found also is that Australians have a fairly one-dimensional view of the First World War. You know, a lot of people believe that what happened in Europe and the Middle East directly affected Australia, and, you know, that's the way that history developed. But it's, of course, much more complex and nuanced than that, because over 95% of the population were here in Australia. Politics was still occurring in Australia. Entertainment and education were still happening here in Australia. So we had to be able to tell the stories of not just famous people, Billy Hughes and Bob Menzies, but, you know, not so famous everyday people like Alice Yoxon and the Narrenjeri Anzacs. And we also wanted to be able to tell stories of innovation and science, sport, and the arts, because these are areas that everybody was involved in. So as I mentioned, with those historical points and those themes in mind, then we were able to generate about 70 different stories. And that's a lot of stories. And we know right away from just the physical space of the studio gallery where it is right now that there's really only room in such a space for 20 to 25 stories. So we have to cut a lot of those stories back. And that's very typical. I mean, you always have way more stories than you actually need in relation to an exhibition because of the culling process. And the culling process, you know, it takes quite a while. It takes, you know, between 6 months and a year for an exhibition this size. And kind of the first line of inquiry around that, of questioning around that, is how do we display that story in a museum environment? Because as a museum, we're telling stories in a three-dimensional environment. You know, we're not writing a book or making a film. We need objects to tell those stories. And the first rule is, if there's no object, there's no story for us. And a good example of that would be Ben Chifley, one of Australia's most famous prime ministers, very active during the First World War. He was a train driver up in Bathurst and was involved in the Great Strike of 1917. And decisions that were made during that time for him affected his political career for the next 40 years. And we looked high and low for an object relating to Ben Chifley during that time and couldn't find any. And so we had to drop a really fantastic story because we don't really have a way to tell it in the museum. And then we have to look at, availability of objects. So if we have an object in relation to a particular story in our collection, in the National Historical Collection, then that makes it much easier for us to tell that story and moves the story up the hierarchy. If we have to go outside and try and loan an object from an external institution like Museum Victoria or the Powerhouse or the Ballarat Historical Society, then that creates difficulties for us, and that story might move down the hierarchy. And also we have to look at the quality of the object in relation to the quality of the story. So an example would be Adela Pankhurst, who was very active during the First World War in the pacifist movement, in the suffragette movement, in the unionist movement. A great story for us, but it was the only object that we could find really in relation to her was a petition that was circulating in relation to her imprisonment during that time. And that's what we call in the museum a flat object. We don't really like flat objects in the museum. Across the lake in the archives, that's their, you know, that's their specialty. We want three-dimensional objects, but Adela Pankhurst's story was so strong that we decided to go with that object to tell the story. And actually, it did work out because her husband was Tom Walsh, who was a unionist. Unfortunately, we got a fantastic object in relation to Tom Walsh, which is the huge trade union banner. So the two of these objects together telling the story really worked well. And also, there's the availability of objects, because a lot of these, because so many institutions across Australia were planning exhibitions and events in relation to the centenary, a lot of these objects that we might have wanted were unavailable because they'd already been asked for by other institutions. And that's a lot of what the exhibition curator's job is marrying up good objects with good stories. And once you have that in place, then things really start to move along. But the other thing that you really need to help people get to the core theme of an exhibition is a good structure. And that was another big part of our decision-making process, well, about a year ago now. we had to decide how were we going to tell this overall story. And there's, you know, different narrative structures that you can use in a museum environment. For example, chronological structure, and that's very common if you go up to the War Memorial. If you go to their new World War I galleries, which are very well done, you'll see a great example of a chronological structure. At the National Museum here, we have used place-based structures quite well. Outside, if you went to Landmark Gallery, you'd see a fantastic example of place-based structure to tell Australian history and culture from the post-contact times. But because this was a biographically based exhibition, we wanted to get to the core of those individual stories. And the way that people really connect with the story is through emotion. And so we decided to go for an emotionally based structure. Now, what does that mean? And what kind of emotions are we going to use? Well, we used a psychological tool that was developed by an American psychologist called Robert Pilchuk, which is an emotional wheel, and it kind of looks like a color wheel. And on it are eight primary emotions and then secondary emotions moving out from that. And they're contrasting emotions. And so one of our big jobs, again, about 12 months ago, was to take the stories that we'd selected, these 23 stories at that point, well, 24, and actually give them a primary emotion. And honestly, you know, that's a completely arbitrary process because all of these stories include many, many emotions. For example, the Narangeri Anzac story, I mean, that's a story that we've classified as one based on pride, but of course there's joy and sorrow involved in that too. But what we wanted to do with this structure was help people break out of that one-dimensional historical view of World War One, and we think that helped people to do that. Now, once you have a story selection and a narrative structure, of course, the next phase is to create a design, a three-dimensional design to tell those stories. And Jill's going to talk about that now.
So this is, for me, I find the design phase of a project the most exciting. This is when all the thinking that you've been doing and the ideas that you've had start to become real and you can start to see how the exhibition might appear in the space. This was also the time that I started on the project, and not long after Jono had started. The designers had already been contracted, and I think they were a little nervous that a new curator coming onto the project would basically throw all the cards up in the air and make them start again. So I was very mindful about what we could change and what the way that I wanted to take the exhibition, or the direction I thought the exhibition should head in. And really the exhibition was in good shape, and it was just at that fine-tuning point. And that is a point that you have in any project, whether you're on that project long-term or not. So the first phase of the design project is what we call concept design. And it's really about the curators and the designers agreeing on a vision for the exhibition. And this is one of the first drawings that we got, and it's really what we would just refer to as a mud map of the exhibition, just kind of plonking things in space and seeing how they might relate to each other. I think what's interesting about this is, in a way, this tracks our thinking through the process. And once the designers are on board, it's not a clear production line in an exhibition. Things work to and fro. We feed off what the designers say. They feed off what we have. We are currently still looking for new objects or interesting objects. So all of this is happening at the same time. And what you can see on this slide here are the five emotions that we had when the designers kind of came on board. And for those of you that have been into the exhibition, you'll see that we have, what I like to say, is refined them somewhat. Because I think, you know, in the way that you try and come up with this stuff. You don't always come up with... Your first ideas are not always necessarily the best, I guess. So, you know, two emotions for me were particularly problematic. One in its titling, which was just suffering, and we felt that sorrow was a much broader... broader term, and it touched on a breadth of experience. The other one was anger, and I felt that that actually did quite a disservice to these people who were grouped under there, because I think while they may have been seen to be angry, what they were was passionate in their views, and they would perhaps have described themselves more as passionate than angry. So that was where we were at when the designers came on board. One thing that this does show, which did translate throughout the exhibition, is that pride is sitting in the centre of the other emotions. And that was a response to the briefing from the curators, that we felt that it was a central emotion, and it was something that pretty much ran through the exhibition and ran through the home front experience. And so the designers respond to our conceptual ideas in that pride is central, and so they make it physically central in the exhibition space. This is the next stage, which where we talk about developed design, and you can see that we now have wall structures, we've got designated showcases, we've got the emotions as we have decided on them. And it's a further refinement and clarifying of our vision. One of the things that we did talk about in the exhibition is what order do we put the themes in? And we talk about them as themes when we're developing the content, but when we get to this point, we start to talk about them as modules because they exist physically. So if I use theme and module during this discussion, they are interchangeable because they go from a concept to a physical structure. And so we did talk about the order, and there was sort of an idea that perhaps sorrow should be the last theme encountered. For those of you that have been into the exhibition, you can really go either way, and personally I don't think it matters which order you engage with the stories. You can meander through, you can double back. What did actually really decide the positioning for sorrow was partly the space that's got quite a low ceiling height in there. So we needed to have showcase structures and objects that would fit under there. But also conceptually it works quite nicely that it's a little bit out of the way and a little bit tucked towards the back. So it does give you a little bit of space from the other stories and emotions. You'll see in the Wonder module up here, there is a curved structure. And it's up in the top middle of this picture. And this is where designers and budgets don't meet. Designers love curves, builders hate them, budgets don't go very well with curved walls either. And this was really driven by our designer. She was desperate to have a curved wall in there. And we sort of let her have her head for a while. And eventually money spoke and we said we can't afford a curved wall. The other thing that we also had to lose because of budget was one of our stories. Jono mentioned briefly before, we sort of whittled it down to 24 stories. And we had a great story, hopefully coming to a Journeys showcase in the next 12 months. But, you know, that's another thing of how sometimes we whittle down an exhibition and how we refine it, is that the decisions are not always our decisions, and they're not always made with glad hearts. They are made with practical hats and bean counters behind us. The other element to design is graphic design. And so the graphic designer and the exhibition designer work very closely, and also work very closely with us as the curatorial team. Our graphic designer always seemed to go above and beyond what we had asked her for. I think she loved the images that we had selected. She liked the idea. She was engaged, and you can see that through the work that she delivered. So this was a very early kind of idea of hers of what the colour palette might be in the exhibition. And she drew the colour palette from the flag, and based on that idea of pride being the central emotion, we also had a couple of flags nominated to be displayed in that area. So she kind of took that notion, developed her colour palette from that. Sometimes working with a graphic designer, you might just get a couple of boxes of colour on a page. But with our graphic designer, we got this, a big wall that she mocked up. When we were installing the exhibition, one of the people that works for the company that prints all these graphics did mutter to me, she used 10 different shades of red. Why couldn't she just use one? I think we agree with our graphic designer that the 10 shades of red actually are pretty spectacular in that space. And maybe it wouldn't have mattered if we just used one, but I think she has actually done quite a good job with that. The other thing that the graphic designer does is develop a typography. And this adds to the look and the feel of the exhibition. So what she drew her inspiration from were the newspaper articles of the day and the newspaper fonts, newspaper styles. What you can see here too is the text on the left was our original working title for the exhibition, What Did You Do in the War? And so that's why those words are there. That's what she was basing her work on, and she was messing around, seeing how those words would fit with the fonts that she had chosen. And in the way that I just mentioned before about exhibitions not being production lines, in concert with the design work that's going on, are discussions about exhibition titles. This is a discussion we have with every exhibition. We don't ever seem to make it easier on ourselves. Everyone has an opinion. But we did feel that What Did You Do in the War was a bit long and clunky, and probably a little bit obscure. What we hope to do with our exhibition titles is really communicate to people that see a poster in a cafe in Canberra and they'll go, I know what I will get when I go to see that exhibition. So we did have a couple of options which we tested on various visitors who were bailed up by our visitor hosts, and we ended up with a very simple title which really does tell you what it's about, which is The Home Front. But still, just back to the graphic designer's typography, selection of fonts, you can see, for those of you that have spent any time on Trove, hopefully you can see some of those newspaper elements in here, the double lines, the dividing up of text into blocks, different types of fonts. I think at that point they had discovered all the fonts, and newspaper editors did like to use as many fonts as they possibly could. So that translated through into our exhibition text. I think one of the things for me with this process is that the design didn't change all that much from that very first concept design through to what we have in the space. And I wasn't really surprised by anything much. Sometimes when you walk into a space when it's being built, you're sort of a bit shocked and think, oh, I didn't think it was going to look like that. And it pretty much did. And I've been wondering why that is. And I think there's a couple of things, because sometimes exhibition designs can change drastically as you go through the process. I think the size of the space and the restrictions that we had limited what we could do in the space and limited what the designer, you know, how many variations the designer could come up with. The other thing was that I think by the time Jono and I came on board, I think we really knuckled down and focused the exhibition content. So it was always very clear. We had a very clear idea of where we were going, and the designers were on the same path with us. So that meant for us a very simple design process. Just finally, one other element in the exhibition is multimedia. And you will see up on the walls there, and for those of you that have been into the galleries, these large, we call them guinea pigs. They are guinea pig-shaped blobs on the wall, and we are screening a series of photographs from the front. And this actually was an idea from the designer, who thought that it would be good to introduce the war, because this really is what is overshadowing life on the home front. So in the background, the exhibition is daily life, but in the background of that daily life is this war. It is hanging over everyone. It is casting a shadow on Australia. And I think it's a testament to the designer that we had that she connected and she had such a great idea, and I'm really pleased that we were able to incorporate it into the exhibition, because I think it adds something that we probably wouldn't have come up with ourselves. Finally, I've had a couple of questions from people who have asked, why is there no music in the exhibition? Did you think about incorporating music from the era? And I have to confess that I didn't think of it at the time. I was actually quite excited about working with silent film. Sound in exhibitions is always problematic. We have trouble getting the levels right. The levels might be great when you're in there, but once a level of, you know, if you're in there with a lot of people, the sound level might be right. If that empties out and it's just you in the exhibition, the audio levels are way too high. Or the other thing is you get a group of school kids come in and you can't hear what's going on because of all the other surrounding sound. So silent film for me was kind of made my job a bit easier. But the other thing Jono and I were talking about was that in a way, that space at the moment, if you're in there with only a few visitors, it's very, very quiet. The downside to that is that it might feel a bit uncomfortable. There's not a lot of ambience. The upside to that is that you could argue that that silence creates a contemplative space and a space for the visitor to engage with the stories and absorb the stories. I'm going to leave that to you to be the judge, and if you haven't already seen the exhibition or you will be going back to see the exhibition, please have a think about that notion of audio and think about what you perhaps would have done had you been the curator? Would you have preferred music, some sound, or do you appreciate the silence? Before we go to questions, Jono and I are just going to briefly chat about our favourite stories. Through the course of an exhibition, you get to like some of the people that you meet through your research. Some you don't care for much by the end. And so we thought we would just share with you our favourite people from the exhibition.
Yeah, well, I mean, I have a few favourite stories, but probably the most favourite story is the story of Hans Overbeck. Now, Hans was a German businessman in Singapore at the start of the war, and because that was a British colony, all the Germans were interned in Singapore. They were held in a prison there, and within 6 months of being interned there, they'd actually been involved in a mutiny of the British Indian Army in Singapore. So the British moved all the German internees to Australia, to the area where now Holdsworthy Barracks is in Western Sydney. And that's where Hans was for a couple of years, and then he got moved up to Trial Bay, which is near Kempsey. And this picture here of all the internees standing on this log is the men when they're up in Trial Bay, and Hansi is the one standing right at the top of the log there. Now, Hans was such an interesting individual because he was someone who was very passionate. He was someone who had interests far beyond business. He was an amateur entomologist, so he collected ants, and he collected ants in Australia, and we think most likely he collected a lot of his ant specimens when he was out on these firewood collecting expeditions up in Trial Bay. And interestingly, he kept the ants, and after the war, when he was repatriated back to Germany, he sent those ants off to a museum there, to a university there, where they were identified, and there was a series of brand new species that were introduced to the world at that point. And so there are a couple of ants that are Overbecki ants. The other interesting thing about Hans was that he was a linguist. So while he was incarcerated, he actually translated some very famous Malaysian myths into German, and those are still in publication now in Malaysia. So he was a really cosmopolitan, well-rounded person. After the war, he returned to Germany, although he didn't want to. He quickly came back to Indonesia. He retired there in the 30s, and unfortunately, Hans was in Indonesia when Japan was threatening to invade the country from Singapore after they'd taken over Singapore. The Dutch were the colonial power at that point in time, so they imprisoned all the Germans again. So poor Hans got imprisoned yet again in Indonesia, and when the Japanese did invade, the Dutch transferred all their German prisoners to British India. However, when those ships containing the prisoners were on their way to Bombay, they were actually torpedoed by Japanese planes, and poor Hans was killed when the ship sank. So it's a tragic story about a very interesting man. And one of the other tragedies about this story is that with exhibition text, in writing exhibition text, you have a very, very limited amount of words that you can actually use. And there's no way that I would be able to convey Hans's story through 100 or to 150 words. But we were very fortunate in that the person that put me onto this story was Professor Bob Taylor. And Bob had a particular fascination with Hans Overbeck. And he was an entomologist himself. So he got us in contact with the CSIRO. He pointed out to me that there was actually a catalog, an album of every one of the 5,000 German-Australian prisoners in internment camps during World War I. It was held by the National Archives, so we were able to get that. And then through the CSIRO, we were able to get the images of some of the ants that Hans collected in Australia. We got those images digitized, and then we were able to work with the multimedia team and get those onto a touchscreen computer so that people could go into the exhibition, look at a selection of the ants that Hans collected, and then go to the touchscreen and actually magnify those 1,000 times. So Hans is an incredible story, but of course there's incredible objects to tell those stories. And that's probably the main reasons why I like him so much.
And strangely, my favourite person came to be Bob Menzies. I was a bit resistant to including Bob in the exhibition. There was external interests at play. But again, in the way of the Chifley story, we didn't actually have an object to tell the story. And for those of you that aren't familiar, when Menzies became Prime Minister, and even sort of, you know, as his political career is developing, he did not fight during the First World War, and bore the label of being a shirker, or someone who, you know, avoided doing his duty to the country in the First World War. And it was a tag that sort of followed him around. So it was an interesting story to tell, but look, we found through the family this amazing little silver serving dish. And it's the story behind this dish that made me rethink perhaps about Menzies. I always had this picture, Menzies the dour Prime Minister, you know, in charge for all of those years, quite a distant person. But the story in the Menzies family is that there were four children. Two eldest boys went away and served. Robert was at university. There were five children. And his sister Isabel was also at home, and his younger brother. Isabel eloped with a soldier, and the family did not approve and cut her off. She became, I guess, isolated from her family. They didn't really want to have anything to do with her after she ran away with a soldier. And Bob was actually the only person that kept in contact with her during the war years. He was the point of communication between the family and Isabel. This silver serving dish was presented to Isabel as a wedding gift by Robert, and it's inscribed Peace Greenie, and Green was her married name. Peace Greenie, and it's dated the 11th of the 11th, 1918. And I think, you know, I'm just supposing here, and we have to be careful, I guess, about the connections we make, but I think it's probably not too difficult to make that connection between Armistice Day and peace from war to peace within the Menzies family. And I think more kindly of Sir Robert having learnt that story of him, because I think what it tells us is that the decisions people make at any time of life, but certainly in times of war, are not as straightforward or as simple as we might think they might be. It was never as easy as him choosing to go to war or not choosing to go to war. Life is much more complicated and complex. And for me, this story makes a political figure a very human figure, and that's why it's my favourite story. So now we've rabbited on for quite some time. I'd like to throw it over to you, and if anyone has any questions.
Thank you. We've enjoyed this very much. I would just like to know, was there reconciliation?
Yes, there was. And I'm sorry I didn't say that. Yes, after the war, the family was reconciled and it seems that all was forgiven and the family was reunited. A happy ending, which during the First World War there weren't very many of those, so it's nice that there was one.
I've got a very loud voice. I was very pleased that you had included that section about Hans, because I think that that was a big problem in the First World War, as it was for Japanese people born in Canada, taken away from their fisheries. And it's sad, I think, that Hans ended up being a prisoner again. What an unusual story. And how did you find the story?
Well, that is actually incredible that you mentioned about Canadians being taken away from fisheries in Canada during World War II, because when I was 17 years old, I worked on a salmon fishing boat in northern Canada, and my skipper was a Japanese man who had been incarcerated during World War II. The way that we found that story was that I read a copy of ANU Reporter, and in the magazine was a brief outline of this particular character, and it was related to the biological science section at ANU, and I thought, wow, this is an incredible story. And we'd actually been looking for a story in relation to German-Australian incarceration in World War I. And the problem had been, as we found, across so many of these stories, was that it was really difficult to find objects that could tell these stories. I mean, there were some very famous Australians who were imprisoned in these camps during World War I. Edmund Resch, who was the founder of Resch Breweries, he was one of the richest men in New South Wales at the time. He was imprisoned. The Attorney General of South Australia was imprisoned. So many people, but we couldn't find any objects. Fortunately, I got in contact with Bob Taylor, and he's the one who told me, well, I know where to find a series of the specimens of ants that Overbeck collected in Trial Bay. I can also get you the high-resolution pictures, and do you know that there's this album in the National Archives? So it's really credit to Bob Taylor for putting us on to this.
And sometimes just a bit of dumb luck too, because yeah. I think, certainly with the Menzies, the dish, we were being pressured, and we have quite a good collection of Menzies material at the museum, but nothing that relates to that early period of his life. And so we contacted the wonderful Heather Henderson, who's a great supporter of all the cultural institutions, it would seem, in Canberra. She did a family ring around. And one of the family members had that dish, and that was, as soon as we found that, we knew we had a great story. So sometimes it's diligence, sometimes it's the people that you speak to, sometimes it's just dumb luck. The cash register that's on display in there in the exhibition related to the Maya story just came about from a chance conversation I had with a staff member at the State Library of Victoria that said that they had a cash register from Coles/Meyer archive. Things happen in mysterious ways when you're a curator.
It sounded to me as if you were writing a book, you get the idea, and then the research people come in, and then the editor comes in and says, you can't have this and you should have that. And then the artist comes in to do the cover. The publisher says the size of the book, how it should be. And congratulations for ending up in such a wonderful exhibition. And I really appreciate you going through all the stages of it, because I think it's quite revealing. So thank you very much, because I went to the books, I think, last week, books from the First World War that you've got in your library here. Mm-hmm. And my 12-year-old granddaughter was with me, having a time of holidays, school holidays. And she came away absolutely razzle-dazzled with the whole thing, how wonderful it was, can't stop talking about it, and said to me today, why can't I go and listen to what you've just been doing? So wow. I have to go home and reveal it all to her.
That is great news, yes. And I agree, there is a lot of similarities between, you know, writing, being involved in a large creative project, whether that be, you know, a film or a book, and creating a museum exhibition, because so much of it is about paring down those stories. The big difference, as I tried to point out earlier, is that the way that you tell the stories in the museum environment is different. You know, in a book, you're telling it through words, through scene and characters. The scene and characters, the characters are there in a museum exhibition, but the way you tell the story is through the objects, because you're given such great restrictions on what you can actually say in the text. That's the importance of the graphic designer, and getting that vision across is very, very important.
In terms of deciding what kind of people you're going to do, whether they're famous or not famous, how did you kind of come up with that sort of combination? Is there pressure point there, or is it just because of that?
I think it's always it's always something that we think about in our exhibitions, in our permanent galleries. I've worked on the Eternity exhibition before, and you're always trying to balance famous with ordinary men and women. You know, where do these people come from? And that is an element that we didn't impose on this, and I've had a comment made several times that it is a very East Coast Australia focus, is very Sydney, Melbourne. And so that is in that decision making. When Jono talked earlier about which stories that you choose, you might get to the end, you whittle down and perhaps you've got 30 and you still need to get it down, and you might say, well, look, really, you know, we've already got a couple of prime ministers, let's not add another one. We've got this many men, we really need to get another woman in. And it's part of that process. It's not done in isolation. All of this is to-ing and fro-ing the whole time. You're thinking, you're refining, and you're just going over and over and over again until sometimes you're really sick of those people, or sometimes you get to love them.
Hi, Joe and Jono. Really great way to present the exhibition, I think. Well done today. One of the things perhaps to let people know in the theatre that there's a lot more material on the website, and you might want to talk a little bit about that. And also that, you know, there are some other interesting aspects of this whole project, such as a website that people can actually contribute to. Providing their own memories. You may have mentioned that at the end anyway, but I thought I'd just Dorothy Dix you.
No, it's not. It's all about the exhibition today.
Yeah, well, of course, we should mention there. This is part of a suite of products and exhibitions that the museum has generated in relation to the centenary. One that we really should point out is the museum has developed a website. It's called Remembering 1914 to 1918, and on that website you can actually upload objects from your own family's history with their story, and they'll appear on the website on a national scale, and that website will be up for the next 4 years. And what we're hoping is that over that period of time we'll create a very large database of Australians' stories and objects in relation to that time 100 years ago. There's also the ability to tag these objects and stories with an emotion. And so the other hope is that over the period of 4 years, we'll create in some ways an emotional archive of how people view the world, First World War. So just Google Remembering 1914, 1918, NMA.
Well done, Doug. I enjoyed the talk much. I've only just finished the book this morning, and the thing that really took me was one of the short stories of the lot, and that was the story on the cocky. And I found that very interesting. Can you find it? Well, it's not much there, I suppose, but can you enlarge a little bit on it, maybe?
I wish I could, actually, on that one, because I think that was one of the stories that the previous curator locked in. So I'm not quite sure. I suspect, actually, she knew the object because she had previously worked at the War Memorial, so she was familiar with the object because Cocky does live at the War Memorial. And it was a really tricky one because how do you include a person or a biography of a bird? So we had to sort of link it with Cocky's owner, Anne Fraser Bond, who's quite an amazing woman in her own right. But really, you know, it's one of those stories that in some way we were talking before about, you know, how do you decide what you keep? It's kind of was the object was too good to let go, and the story was just really nice how that bird is used, you know, now we're very aware of the whole pets as therapy type approach. You know, animals are brought into nursing homes and into hospitals, and Fraser Bond was kind of ahead of her time and thought Cocky would be a great therapeutic tool for the soldiers in the number one rest home in Melbourne. And so, yeah, look, again, someone knew of that object in a collection and that's how the story came out. And once you know of Cocky, how could you cross him off your list of potential stories?
I'm sure we all found that very interesting, just like I did. It was really fascinating to see how you put the exhibition together. And I just wanted to take the opportunity to thank you all and to tell you about the next lecture and film screening, which is happening in June, as you can see from our slide here. We've got the pleasure of having two very interesting speakers. We've got the Anastasios couple, who were the authors of the novel The Water Diviner, and the co-script writer for the screenplay. So we have a really interesting lecture and a film screening that we hope you can join us for. Thank you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.